Hey, Alan or Yaku, can you hear me?
Hey Mallory, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Excellent.
All right, we're gonna take another minute just to let the entire crowd come in. Okay. Gonna share the screen. I think we're cooking with gas now. Can everybody see the screen?
Yes.
All right. All right, so I'm going to start. My name is Alan Jones. I am the Senior Director of Digital Library and Technical Services at the New School, a small, scrappy school in Greenwich Village, New York. We do a lot of resource sharing work, as well as a lot of work in standards. So if you guys hear me say 18626, you drink. If I get into ISIL symbols, well, then it's the hard stuff. So we're gonna do a kind of take a tour around kind of the evolution of the standard, kind of what it is that we've been doing with Reshare, as well as some things within ALMA as well. In terms of talking about interoperability, I'm gonna talk a little bit about lessons learned, hopefully. We will have a demo a live demo of kind of what it is, the work that's actually going on within Trove and Caval to actually build a national lending network. And then we'll conclude with what the next steps are going to be for the 18626 protocol. So drink. So with that, I also want to introduce my colleague, Jakob Skozen, from Index Data, who's been the lead architect for Crosslink, as well as working on the Reshare project as well. So many thanks go out to IDS as well. IDS has been a critical partner and sponsor in a lot of the work that's been going on. So this has been probably in my 30 years and working in library, one of my favorite projects. So if I kind of go on and on about it, it's because literally this was the kind of thing, especially with the time zone shift in Australia, where you would be up late at night actually seeing if stuff would actually work. And when it did, it was addictive. Okay, just let's talk a little bit about kind of, we talked a little bit about the agenda. And let's just talk about setting the stage. How did we actually get here? Well, how many people have actually heard of SILT? Okay, the two people in the back, but I mean, come on, you guys are Reshare. So what SILT basically is it's an organization called the Center for Interlibrary Loan Transactions. It's the maintenance agency that's responsible for the current version of ISO 18626. Prior to that, there was, I told you, you're going to be drunk by the end of it. It's the maintenance agency that is responsible for the current version of this ILL protocol. This protocol is responsible for sending messages between a supplying library and a requesting library to actually fill requests back and forth. And it started many, many years ago. There was a version prior to that, which was 10.160 and 10.161. 10.160 basically being kind of the semantic rules and the semantic structure, and 161 actually being the structure of each of the messages. What happened was with 18626, drink, there was a decision to try to make this a little bit more web friendly. So if you remember back in the day, if you can remember your OSI stack, where there were protocols and then there were different types of transports and other, you know, layers upon layers of network traffic. What it did was it evolved something that used to be kind of a machine level protocol to something that was a web friendly protocol. And so that opened up a lot of different possibilities, thus the new 18626 standard. This group was probably, it goes all the way back till about 2014 with the first version. But it brought together a number of different vendors, Ex Libris being one of them. I don't even know what to call. Actually, is it Clarivate? Is it ProQuest? Is it whatever? But it also brought folks like Autographics, as well as Atlas, as well as OCLC, and a number of different groups around the same table to basically talk about what are the practitioner problems and how are they actually expressed in the protocol. So it's a really interesting group of implementers and practitioners and actually trying to figure out how this stuff would actually talk kind of across the table. Were things that people were building used, or were they just kind of left to the table? So that group is actually composed of three different groups. I'm going to just move this. There's the editorial committee that's actually responsible for the actual definition of the protocol. We're the ones that actually write the XSD files that define what the protocol is, what it does, and what it won't do. There's a library advisory group that are the group of practitioners. And as I said, they're the implementers who are the people, the developers within the different vendors to actually implement this. Now, there's something that's really important about this transition from 10.160 to 10.1, or from 10.160, 161 to 18.626. The messaging, One of the things that the earlier form did that the later form did not was it assumed a certain set of steps and a certain set of states that had to happen. You had to say expects to supply before you say you would supply it. And after you would supply it, you'd have to say shipped, right? So there's certain sequence of steps that used to have to happen. That didn't happen with 18626. It was much more open. And so there was a lot of interesting creativity that happened, but it also meant that even if you weren't using the standard, or even if you were using the standard, if the state models didn't align, then you could potentially not be compatible. So certain things like will supply, for example, is it something that happens once? Is it something that happens multiple times? Is it something that actually happens with updates? All those rules went out the window with 18626 because those were defined in the previous version. There you go. So, as I said, SILT is the maintenance agency for this protocol, and Working Group 4 out of the International Standards Organization is responsible for the draft of the new version. We're going to talk about the new version much later. There have been three versions that have been out. The first one basically adopted it from a network protocol to a web protocol. The second one brought in conditional logic as well as other types of features, different types of shipping features, and other things. The third protocol, which was the 2021 version, focused much more on electronic lending as well as digital lending, brought in some innovations around controlled digital lending. And then this new version has actually got a number of new features that I think everybody will be interested in. We talked a little bit about this. The parts of the ISO message, in case anybody's interested besides me, you can see that there's a lot of information that's actually carried back and forth. One of the things that is really interesting is that with the protocol, you can actually send something as simple as a bibliographic identifier and no other bibliographic information, like an OCLC number or like a national library number, or you could send as much bibliographic data as you want. The service info may have information like what protocol should I actually send this PDF over in order for you to pick it up in. Things like the requesting agency information and billing information is if you're going to charge for something. So there's a number of different components from the requester side. This is, for example, in the service info, a piece of information that's really relevant is how much am I willing to pay for this thing? Now, the joke is that when 2017 came out, it's a string, it's actually not a readable number. So there are certain things like that that are really important to begin kind of thinking about and getting right as we start talking about fees and fines and delivery service fees, and how we're actually going to communicate that in the new version of the protocol. On the supplier side, you'll see that there are a number of other things like the delivery info, whether it's FTP, whether it's email, whether it's whatever. We also included in the 2021 version of a URL. So, in case somebody actually wanted to pick something up, or more importantly, if you were a controlled digital lending object, this would be where you need to go in order to get it, as well as the possibility of including a name and password authentication information for somebody to actually access that object. So we talked a little bit about it being, a web protocol. It's much more simplified in terms of what it is you can and you can't do. You can see here there's a workflow profile. One of the things that's important about the supplier and the requester is you all have to agree on what it is you're willing to support and what it is you're not willing to support. So if you check a whole bunch of things off here, like lost and damaged, and the other person doesn't know how to interpret the message, those are just going to basically result in errors. So one of the things you can see with 18626 is that it's really dependent on what it is that what the listener of that protocol could actually do, not what the sender wants to do. And so there needs to be a lot of alignment in terms of in terms of which messages you can actually, you're all willing to support. Now, let's talk a little bit about Alma and let's talk a little bit about reshare because we're talking about the different state models and the sequences of what was supposed to happen. So you'll see here that we can start with a new request, but in reshare, there's that expects the supply step. In Alma, it goes directly to will supply. Why? Because what Alma does when it gets a new request is it looks in the inventory automatically. There's no need to send expects to supply because it's not actually going back to the library and saying, okay, I got the request, but I haven't found it yet. Alma is basically going to the step of we have it or we don't. So for Alma, will supply, it's either will supply or unfulfilled. You're done. And part of that's based on the different philosophies that these different ILSs actually grew up on. With reshare, there's much more of a conversation that might happen between two libraries before they're willing to ship something. With the ISO standard, the way that Alma's implemented it, it's if you haven't found the thing, then you want to go to a supplier that actually can provide it. And so rather than kind of gumming things up and stopping and having a conversation, it's just moving on to the next supplier in the rota. The more important thing here, or the takeaway is both of these versions are completely compliant within the ISO standard. But what happens when reshare actually sends and expects the supply step and Alma can't, it doesn't even know it. It doesn't even know how to interpret it. And so when people were starting to put things into RFPs, like it's ISO 18626 compliant, what the heck does that mean? You could have two completely different systems saying they're talking the same standard, but they're not actually compatible with one another. That's what that means. And so we go to will supply. You'll see the status change in terms of whether the thing is loaned. This is a returnable piece of this. There's a status change as far as whether it's shipped. All of that's basically the same. Received, ship returned. So it's almost the same, except for that one step. And that one step not happening basically means everything else after that one step won't be updated within Alma or won't be updated within reshare. So the state dependency piece of the protocol is really important. It does, you know, getting rid of it offered a whole bunch of complexity, but so much complexity that it made it interoperable, or it made it not interoperable. So again, just going back to certain things, reshare uses these types of conditionals almost in like a chat type of client, right? I'm sending something and saying, well, I'm willing to loan it to you, but I don't want you to check it out to the patron. You have to use special collection handling for it. Or I'll lend this to you thing, but you can't copy it. Or in the Australians' instance, I have to go through a data sovereignty check in order to see if the tribe will actually let me lend this or not. So there are a number of different conditions that have to be met in order for something to go out or not, and how those things are fulfilled. But if your system doesn't support conditionals in the same way, then you could literally be talking the same talk, but not understanding one another. Again, you know, when you think of Alma and kind of Rapido, you're thinking that things are getting fulfilled as fast as they possibly can. So if you're offering a conditional, as far as that speed bump goes, it's not really it within the Alma Rapido world, it's just going to move it to the next supplier. And for most supplier logics, that makes absolute sense. But if you're starting to think about lending or potentially lending special collections over that network, there may be things like insurance fees or other types of things that you're going to want to make sure are part of that transaction. Okay, so you can kind of see the different philosophies that are baked into these two systems and what it is that this means in terms of trying to get these two to interoperate. So, EnerTrove and Caval. there was a particular problem that they had. Oh, the other thing I want, the final thing I wanted to say about ISO 1866, it is completely and utterly defined as a library talking to another library. So you have a requesting library that's talking to a supplying library. And so what happens when that requesting library and that supplying library kind of go out? Typically, at least at New School, one of the things we used to do is we used to throw it at Rapid. You'd throw it out to a network or you'd throw it to somewhere else. ISO, the ISO protocol as it currently stands, doesn't actually support network-to-network connectivity or library-to-network connectivity. What I think the CrossLink project actually did was it showed we could actually begin thinking about what that might look like. And so with that, I'd like to bring Jakob up to actually talk a little bit about what the CrossLink platform is, as well as what it's able to do. So, Jakob.
Thank you, Alan. So my name is Jakob Skotsen, and I'm a chief architect with Index Data. I used to work a lot with Folio. And for some for a couple of years now, I've been working also with the Reshare project. I've not been involved since the inception of that project, but I have, you know, joined the team, I think, 2 years ago. So I'll talk a little bit about the implementation of the broker. Alan mentioned, you know, how the protocol looks like, how it works, and, you know, what it's meant to be used for. So I'll just give you some examples on where we had to use it in a slightly innovative ways to make it work with the broker-based solution. All right, so the quick agenda, I'll talk a little bit about the features of a broker-based solution, then some examples of how we use ISO 18626 in that setting. I'll be geeking out a little bit on the design and implementation. Do we have any technical people here? Like any programmers? Okay, and I'll try to make it short. And then we'll just talk about some planned future development, and I'll give you some credits where you can, you know, get the software basically, because it's an open source project, of course. All right, so features of a broker-based ILL solution. So I would say the main benefit of that approach is that you get a unified solution that can plug with existing systems. When you have a peer-to-peer system like ALMA, for example, a lot of the functionality required for ILL is not actually part of the protocol. So things like locating the holdings, you know, who's got the item that I need, and then how do I actually contact those potential suppliers that can give me the item. None of that is part of the protocol. If you have a broker-based solution, you can still have a peer-to-peer system that is not bothered with any of those details, and then the broker provides that functionality. Discovery, pluggable discovery is another element. So when we were putting the broker solution together, we wanted to have a way for it to use different sources of information for holdings. We try to rely as much as we can on standards like SRU, search retrieval via URL, for example. But we have some adapters that can turn other kinds of protocols into an SRU. So you could hook up Solr, Elastic, or any other index, for example, by using Index Data's meta proxy. So that's one solution. Or we have a project which is part of Reshare, you could say at this point, and it provides a shared index implementation where you can ingest data using OIPMH. It's called Reservoir. So that's another option for plugging in the discovery system. And then the directory service is essentially a place where you store information about the peers, the requesters and suppliers, and use that service to identify what are they capable of, like what's the vendor for the ISO 18626 implementation, how to reach it, you know, what's the link, what's the URL, and so forth. So like all the settings, all the information about the peers, the suppliers and requesters is contained within that directory. And we have externalized that piece so that different sources of information can provide data to the broker. So there is a contract between the broker and the directory system, which is external to it, that defines how that data flows. And you can put that directory API on top of anything. For Trove, for example, we don't actually have a standalone system. We're using a spreadsheet, basically, where that information is being provided to us and exported into a JSON format. All right, let me move on because I think we'll be losing some time here. So this is the simplified systems diagram for the Crosslink broker based ILL platform. In the middle, you can see the Crosslink broker. It's backed up by the Postgres database, and that's really the only sort of infrastructure dependency for it. And you can see different peers. So all peers communicate with the broker via ISO 18626. So we've got a requester on the left and potential suppliers on the right. We have also two external services that the broker uses to first locate the holdings. So the holding service, that's using the SRU protocol, as I mentioned. And then you can really see that. But at the top, we have the directory service with a directory with a JSON API-based contract. All right, so how is ISO 18626 used in the broker-based setting? So while we, as Alan mentioned, ISO 18626 is a peer-to-peer protocol. So it really describes the messages that are being sent from the requester to the supplier. It does not cover any of the, you know, how to locate holdings, how to actually prepare a list of potential suppliers elements. You know, that's totally out of the scope for the protocol. So that's where the broker comes in. It provides those elements seamlessly. And then the other thing is message routing. So in a broker, in a ISO 18626 system, since you're sending messages directly to the peers, it's your responsibility to figure out how to do it. In a broker-based system, all the routing is completely abstracted away. So it's performed in the broker, and you don't need to, as a requester, you don't need to worry about the mechanics of that. However, when you want to use the broker in an existing system, there's some limitations. So for example, as we mentioned with Alma, there is some limitation in what the Alma can do. So we have introduced two different modes in the broker. An opaque mode, which allows you to essentially plug any regular peer-to-peer ISO 18626 client. And in that mode, the broker does not reveal the actual supplier behind the scenes. So the requester in this mode sees only the broker as the potential peer. So all the exchanges look like they go between the peer and the broker. And then we have the transparent mode. And in that mode, we're able to do a little bit more. So provide more rich functionality, rich experience, but the client needs to be aware of this. So we have extended reshare. We've modified reshare a little bit to make sure that it can use the broker in that richer mode. And that allows you to reveal the supplier identities, and so to enable supplier tracking, so you can see actually where within the route that you are. You can detect local supply modes. So essentially, if the ILL request goes in, but you the library actually holds the item, broker can kind of let you know about this. Hey, you know, this does not need to be sent out because you have the item locally. And we can do a bit more advanced messaging. So we can allow messaging between the requester and all the past suppliers, all the skipped suppliers. And we can do a bit more granular cancellation. I'll talk about this a little bit. So specifically for the supplier identification. So Alan showed you the basics schema for the message and some fields that are part of the message. With the broker-based system, the broker is able to inject that data directly into the message. So if the system is unaware of the directory service, and that's the goal, to make it essentially unaware of the directory service, it still needs to know the supplier still needs to know where to send the item, and the requester needs to know where to return it. So all that information will be injected by the broker into the message. So when the message arrives, it will automatically, you know, inject it from the directory, so that, you know, the ILL exchange can happen. And we're using a special form of expect to supply to inform the requester about the switched supplier in the transparent mode. We also have those granular cancellations. And what that means is that we support two forms of cancellation. So a cancellation that sort of terminates the whole transaction. So imagine that you have a request and then multiple suppliers behind the scenes. You send the termination, it will cancel with the active supplier and then terminate the whole transaction. Or a cancellation that allows you to skip to the next supplier. And it can be for different reasons. One reason is that you received conditions that you don't want to approve. You want to reject them, move to the next supplier. Or maybe the request is too long with a specific supplier and you simply want to cancel and move on. So you have that option too. And then condition negotiation. So Alan mentioned the conditions. There isn't really a standard way to do this in ISO 18626, or different, maybe put differently, the standard way is just not implemented by anybody in the industry. So different vendors have different approach to it. Resure has a very rich and sophisticated system for condition negotiation, and that includes cost. So in Trove, for example, we have a paid tier when you need to pay for the resource with some baseline price, but that price may be increased as part of that negotiation mechanism. So Resure does that in a very rich way. You have, like, you know, checkboxes that you can use. You can send some human readable messages. Alma does not have it. So that's also where the broker comes in. We have a layer that tries to normalize that, convert that into a form that other systems like Alma can understand. So you can still do condition negotiation across different systems. And so that's regarding ISO 18626. I'll just very quickly cover some implementation details for the broker. So our goal for the system was to create a very lightweight service. The main deployment target for the service is cloud, obviously, AWS and similar cloud solutions. And we want to make sure that it's cheap to run. So it's written in Go and with minimal dependencies. It's extremely small, so the whole container image is around 50 megabytes, which is tiny. Quick startup, low resource use. So that's what we have achieved with this approach. Protocol first design. So unlike Java, Go does not have great support for XML schema. XML schema is probably the most popular way of defining library, you know, technology protocols at this point, used for, excuse me, ISO 18626, but also SRU and ANSEP. So we have developed a special tool for handling that piece. So all the message datagrams, all the message structures are auto-generated to make sure that we are compliant. One thing that we decided to do differently with the broker compared to Resure, for example, and other systems, we're not using an external messaging mechanism, just to keep it simple. So we're using Postgres, which is the database that is also used for storing transactions for that messaging. So we're not using Kafka, for example, which again would increase that deployment cost. And we have some because we're using the database in a relatively non-standard way, we need to be a fairly low level, but also want to have clean database access code. We're using something called SQL C, which is a SQL compiler, basically. So we're not using an ORM. Some people that maybe know Resure will have some comparison there. It lets you still use it in a clean way, but much lower level. And we have the API derived specification. So that's standard in Folio, but in some cases this has not been true. So basically there's a spec for the API. The API is used to interface with the broker, you know, monitor the transactions, monitor the event log and so forth. So so that's done in a, based on a spec. Okay, so that's implementation. Big thing when you're putting together an ILL system is integration testing. So you have limited opportunity to actually test real systems, real ILSs and real ILL, you know, real life ILL systems. So what do? I mean, you can write unit tests, and we have huge, you know, very, very large level, high level of unit test coverage. But that's not enough. So what you end up doing is, you know, you do a lot of manual verification, you know, testing across systems, creating requests and so forth. And that was also the case here, but we wanted to simplify that. So we have built a tool called ILL Mock, which basically allows you to simulate certain ILL behaviors. You know, it can let you simulate loan and copy workflows, renewals, overdues, and so forth. So we use it both to test the software as part of the integration test, but it's also a standalone tool that you can actually use if you want to verify if, you know, if your ILL system is compliant. So we did use that to verify both Reshare, Alma, and we're going to use it, you know, for other kinds of systems. And a big thing with this broker-based approach is that you can have a layer in the system that allows you to deal with different quirks when it comes to protocol implementation. So as Alan mentioned, even if you are compliant with the protocol on the schema level, there will still be differences. And those systems may not necessarily talk to each other. So we have actually a big, a pretty fat layer in the broker that allows you to make sure that those messages are converted in such a way that those systems can talk to each other. And it's very sort of very extensible. And that's also a nice thing about this approach, that you can have that layer centralized and written once, basically. And you can add additional support for different vendors if you want to. All right, so that's regarding the implementation and testing. And I'll just talk quickly about the future steps. So we're always using the system in Trove. Alan and Mel are going to show it in action in a moment. But we want to sort of enable more use cases. So we're adding a patron request API. That's going to be a new component in the broker that will allow different systems to create requests directly in the broker. So it will be another way to create requests, not necessarily via ISO 18626, but directly by, you know, interfacing with the API. However, we are doing it still retaining the core of the broker to operate, making it operate on the ISO 18626 messages. So internally, the broker is ISO 18626 specific. It's message oriented. It will just offer different ways of initiating the request. And that will allow us to mix and match different kinds of suppliers in the same transaction. So if you have an ILL transaction, you might have some remote suppliers, you know, that you communicate via ISO 18626, or you might have some local ones, you know. So if you're hosting a system for those local tenants, they will just be created locally. You will not have the network overhead. And then the other feature that is planned, I'm just going to skip this, is the Ansible integration. So to provide DCB support, but also to have a traditional ILL with ILS integration, you need an Ansible. So that's what we're also working on adding to the broker. It's a quick sort of diagram of how the patron request API is going to look like in practice. So it's very similar to the other mode that I showed you. The only difference is that we have a different protocol between the requester and the broker, and the supplier too is that local case that I mentioned, where the supplier is actually directly integrated with the broker and managing the lending request directly in the broker. But you can mix those modes, right? So you have supplier one, which is still operating using ISO 18626. If you're interested in the software, here are some pointers. So it's an open source community driven project. It's been built by Index Data, but led by the IDS project and supported by the IMLS. It's AGPL 3.0 license. So it's an open source license. There's a GitHub repo that you can look at. There's some documentation in the repo, and we also publish Docker images. So if you want to get this deployed, it's very easy. It's out there. Thank you.
So now we get to the demo. Before we get to the demo, though, I also want to just reflect on how much time and energy that went into this. Not just on the development side in terms of index data or IDS, but Ex Libris put a tremendous amount of time in actually testing this with us. And I want to just make sure people understand that they were as much a partner in this in terms of their commitment to the standard as anybody. And so being able to see Alma actually interoperate with other systems outside of itself was just gigantic. And it really was something that was useful. So Mal, I see you're there. I've sent you a couple of requests. I'm gonna go into my Alma instance and hopefully you'll be able to see the requests. I will just talk them through in terms of what they are. The first one is called how to tell when your dog is plotting to kill you. So hold on just a second. I'm going to go to Alma. So here we have a borrowing request. You'll see. I'm going to just send this. Oops. And of course, it's missing an identifier. Okay. Send that. And you'll see that the request was sent to the partner. So, and you'll also see that that Crosslink has actually given it an identifier already. So hopefully she'll see that on the will supply side.
I so far have not seen a request come in. So,
this is the live demo.
Yeah, I here, let me share my screen, but I don't think I have anything too exciting to show you yet. Are you seeing the Sydney dev tenant?
Hold on a second. Let's see. I will send this again.
Maybe at the same time, I can try to send you one just to see if,
yep.
Yeah. All right. Well. What was your title? How to kill a dog,
or how, no, to, how to
know
tell
if your
whether
dog's
you're
going to kill you?
No, it was how to tell whether your dog is plotting to kill you.
Okay. So I'm just putting together hopefully a test request for Alan. I'm going to submit this as a book request. In the premium pay for peer rush loan tier, which is something that was introduced for Trove. And let's see if we can get a request through to you, Alan. It looks like it has identified the new school as a supplier.
Yep. Let's see. So I'm going to send another request to you, which is how to tell whether your parrot is plotting to kill you. Not how to kill your parent, that, or not parent, parrot, just to be clear. Let's see, we've got a return. I'm going to send this directly to Trove. To the sandbox. physical item, so it's going to be a loan. And
Alan, are you also sharing your screen?
Hold on a second. I might be. Were you? Oh, you were sharing your screen. So let me.
I mean, I can stop if you want, but I didn't know if we could show both.
I don't know if we'll be able to show both.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, I've got your screen up. You're just going with the blah of test, right?
So my request to you was called My Title Isn't Funny, but I have not
Okay.
received a request from you yet.
All right, hold on just a second.
We did practice earlier today, just in case anyone is doubting us.
No, live demos are never.
Honestly, this is one of the best live demos I've ever seen.
Let's try this again. Created the borrowing request. I'm gonna send it. Request was there. Oops.
Did not get the request part.
Hold on just a second. I'm going to go to the lending requests and see about that. And one of the things that Trove is doing, just for people to be aware, let's see. My title isn't funny, so there it is.
Here, I'll stop so that you can show yours for a second.
Okay. So everybody can see that we've got it. We've got it's come in. Now locate failed because, well, it's a made up title. So, but I am actually going to, I'm actually going to locate the resource. It's going to ask me to locate something.
Alan, will you share your screen, please?
I should be sharing. Hold on a second. Oh. You got it? Can you
yes,
see it?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
All right. I am just going to. I'm going to grab an item here. Second. I will select. Okay. Oops. Now we can see that. Hold on. The item is actually associated with this particular item. Now, again, as Jakob was saying, that at least the way that it's been implemented in the way it's been implemented in Trove is that within Alma they're actually having to manually locate the item instead of actually automatically finding it. So I'm gonna just grab this, grab the item. Whoops. Let me grab this item. Oops. Having a Mac moment here. Need a barcode scanner, yeah. Hold on just a second. Where is the request? Hold on. Ship the item. Put the barcode in. Ugh. Let me get another barcode. So the item shipped. So Mal, do you want to actually show your screen so you can show that it shipped?
Absolutely. So this is the request I submitted to Alan, SYD-320. It's in the ship status now. I don't know if Alan mentioned anything to me. Yes, he added a base fee and some other currency information. And I'm going to mark this as received. And I'll just say, like, thanks, Alan. Scan it in. And so now this is checked into Reshare. I'm not 100% sure what it looks like on Alan's side now that I say this, but he may have gotten something to indicate that I received it. But yep. I'm just going to go through with the, oh, you did. Okay, good. I'll go through with the returning steps so that we can check it out on his side once we've returned shipped the item. So just pretend that like a couple weeks have passed and that I'm sending it back. So this is now in return ship, and it will stay in the status until Alan completes on his side. I can stop share.
So then on my side, yeah, this is Alma.
Are you sharing your screen?
In a second. Okay. Let's just update the transaction. You'll see that it's returned by partner, so it's shipped. Now it's been returned. And I can check it in. So long. Oops. And thanks for all the fish. Loan completes, and then it completes over on the reshare side or on the crosslink side as well. And it's basically done. And we can do a similar type of thing for non-returnables as well. With non-returnables, the difference being that it will, with Alma, it will send an email with an external link to the PDF. And within Reshare, it'll also send a similar type of notice. So instead of actually getting a book, you've got the email with the link that this that the patron can download. So just aware of time, I do want to talk a little bit, but that's basically from front to end, working with CrossLink, working with Alma, and working with Reshare. So we sent it to the broker, which actually, if you saw that in that particular case, we actually had a return ISIL slug, which sent it to a specific partner within the broker. So you can also do peer-to-peer, as well as do send something to the entire broker to have the loan fulfilled as well.
Does it make sense to look at that pull slip?
What's that?
Does it make sense to look at the pull slip?
Not after I've grabbed the loan. The print slip won't print. But yeah. Let's see. Okay. The so we talked a little bit about some of the request workflow as well. Whoops. Did I not share it again? I thought it was still sharing. I'll share the whole thing. Okay. Now, we talked a little bit about this with respect to Trove and Caval. Basically, they're grabbing the requests. They're doing their own locate within their system, whether it's Alma or whether it's if it's Reshare, it's automated. The ROTA is coming back. It's finding the suppliers. And then there, one of the things that Jakob didn't also talk about is not only is it assembling a list of suppliers, but one of the really important things that CrossLink does is it actually figures out the load balancing. So no one partner is actually it's not the first partner that's always the one that's supplying something. And I think that's a really important feature of CrossLink as well. You can see basically here's the implementation timeline of how much work went into it, when Alma and Rapido went live, when we started actually doing pay for peer, where we actually were sending out costs for loans as well as for copies. That's active and going on. The thing to realize about this particular project, Caval is about 11 or 12 different academic institutions, but Trove is over 400 libraries that are doing this. So this isn't a small kind of thing where we're talking about two or three, you know, folks changing back and forth. We're talking a very large scale across all of Australia. So we went through the demonstration. So there were a lot of things that we actually learned about this. You know, as Jakob and I were talking about, the syntaxes between the two systems, very different. One of the things that I've appreciated the most, particularly with folks like Mike Richens, Tom Jacobson's in the audience as well, and Katie Birch, is they've been incredibly supportive in thinking about kind of how can a system that's a vended system actually work with either open source systems or other types of systems using the standard, knowing this limitation that the state models actually aren't baked into any of these systems. And we've all basically made this up as we've went along. So a lot of this work has actually informed what the next version of the protocol is actually going to look like. Here are some of the features that we're planning on working on for the 2027 release. Fees and payment information, not just using IFM, but using potentially other types of different vendors. This may also include for charge things like Reprints Desk. If you could imagine something like Reprints Desk or the British Library or other document providers in a type of system, if they go through all of the free partners and the only place that has it is a place like Reprints Desk, they should be able to talk 1866 and fulfill that within the ILL network. So the idea being that you're not going out to some external system in order to fulfill this particular request, you're actually staying within the request management system. Working on an extension framework to actually try, instead of having to wait for every new major release of the protocol, having to have an extension that basically says, here are the core set of messages that we are considering compliant, but these other things are functionality that we're interested in playing around with. Better error handling so that it's actually written in more practitioner-friendly language. Pickup location information. There are some libraries that want to send directly to either patrons themselves or to locations within a particular library system. Better support for digital lending and document delivery, different types of emerging protocols that are coming up. One of the things that's been a bit of a bone of contention has been around encryption and authentication services. There are some vendors that want to require that an API key be used in order to work with 1866, and there are other vendors who are using a much more open framework to that so that anybody can lend to anybody. So you can imagine kind of some of the friction that's going on there. The question being, should the protocol be able to support both types of authentication platforms? The network to network, as well as network to library to many networks. One of the things that has been explored here is kind of the library being the center, and whether it's a network or whether it's another library, the library should be able to determine who it lends to and in what order. Machine readable implementer profiles, that's kind of a thing to really move towards an open directory type of platform so that there are many national libraries that issue their own symbols. That's something that something like Crosslink should be able to plug into instead of having to rely on it on its own. At the same time, Ex Libris and others are putting out their own open directory APIs. We should be able to leverage those as well. And we've talked enough about conditionals. So these are the folks that are actually working on the implementers team. You can see Jakob is on that as well. I'm on that. I'm on this as well. There are plenty of folks from OpenRS, from Index Data, from COA, from Atlas Systems, IDS. One of the things that I think I appreciate the most is we can actually get around a table and not sue each other. And we actually get some things. It's an incredibly productive conversation. The goal of the group is consensus. So these are kind of the rules of engagement here. If we can't reach consensus on a particular issue, we'll actually come up with a set of recommendations that'll actually go out to folks in the industry. The notion of the parking lot, and I think the most important is the fourth bullet there, any mention of AI will cost you about $10,000. So that's the swear jar. So a lot of this actually is really, AI can happen before this, but a lot of the ILL transaction is human. And it's important to recognize that and to kind of keep the protocol actually rooted in a lot of these use cases. So we're going to be starting in early October. The timeline basically goes through May of 2024. And if you are interested in participating, here's the timeline as far as what it is that we're working on and when. You'll see that we go all the way to December of 2026, which is effectively 15 months from now. Solve all of these problems, then have world peace and everybody votes on it and we can all interoperate with one another, right? So I do want to mention something about getting involved because, you know, people here are practitioners as well as coders, as well as a number of other places or a number of other roles. We are desperately looking for subject matter experts who are interlibrary loan experts. Not because we've got plenty of folks on the vendor side. What we need are people who are in the weeds, in the dirt, who are actually aware of the types of problems that are that this new version of the protocol is going to have to address. So there is an email, which is ISO18626ILL@gmail.com, if you are interested in participating in any of these conversations. Please email your interest. The one thing I will say about this group, it is a working group. Expect to work anywhere from 3 to 5 hours a month. And part of that is just going to be in meetings to try to understand use cases. A lot of it is really trying to put to author user stories that can then get turned into messages and models for messaging between suppliers, networks, and requesting libraries. So with that, we just want to thank everybody. I know it's been a little bit of a grueling demo, but if you have any questions or any comments or anything, we'd love to hear from you. Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have one question about the ILL demo. It looked like you were selecting the other participating libraries in 18626 as like separate vendors or separate people to connect to. And were you sending requests out blind, not knowing they had them, or were you...
So that's actually really... Let me actually talk with you a little bit about the way this is set up. And this goes back to exactly what Jakob was talking about in terms of there are two different modes that CrossLink actually works with. One is mm-hmm. transparent, right? Where it's actually managing all of the transactions between all of the libraries. That's the reshare model. The other model, I'll just talk a little bit about partners. Oops. And before Mallory tells me to share my screen one more time.
You are. I can see it.
You're going to see here basically that the entire Trove network is a single partner within Alma. So it's sending it to the network. It's not sending it to an individual library within the network. And okay. So the way to think about this with Alma is it's almost a rota within a rota, right? I mean, you have your list of libraries, and this is the way we work on it at New School, is that we've got, you know, we have local requests, and then once it goes to local, then we send it to Reshare. Mm-hmm. If Reshare can't cover it, then we send it to Rapido. Once we send it to Rapido, it can go to anybody, and if we don't get it from Rapido, we turn it into a purchase request. Done and done.
Okay. The requests are going out the network. What are you using for a match? Are you using title, a control number to make sure that you've actually found it?
That's a really good question. So as Jakob was saying, within the Trove and Caval network, they have their own ANBD. So it's the Australian National Bibliographic mm-hmm. Identifier, right? And they're using that across networks. What I'm doing at New School is we have a lookup script that actually looks up the reshare ID. We put that in the remote resource identifier or ID. And since we're already matched against what's going on in Rapido, that identifier will find a supplier within that network. And if not, then we could turn it into a purchase request. So unlike the shared index that Reshare is, we are actually using the Rapido index and placing all of our requests against the Rapido index. So it's worked out really well. We're averaging around anywhere from 70 to 100 requests a day. So, and it's been pretty, except for music scores where it sucks, but music scores suck for everything. You know, it's been a really useful way of getting things done. And let's be clear about a couple of things too, particularly with the identifiers. Reshare, the fill rate is somewhere around anywhere from 75 to 80%, at least within Palsy. Okay, part of the reason that we decided to go with Rapido was to close that, right? So that we could have other other libraries that would that we could fill from. And so the identifier of the protocol itself, the identifier is not part of the protocol itself. And so one of the things I'm really interested in doing is seeing if we can actually take and create a vendor agnostic matching algorithm that would basically match against different public fields within a bib record. It's much larger down, you know, one of the things with 18626, the only thing that matters with it is supplier to requester. Doesn't care how you locate it, doesn't care how you find it or any, all of that stuff. It's just the message from one to the other to say, did you ship it or not? It's very dumb that way. But these identifiers are becoming increasingly important in terms of being able to support the network.
Have you looked at maybe a title key or like a hash of some of the fields?
I mean, we've done a lot of matching. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're using the Gold Rush algorithm to do it.
Okay.
But I think there are better ways of doing that because there are a lot of things that the Gold Rush key is kind of dependent on. For example, publisher name. John Wiley and Sons and Wiley are effectively the same thing, but there isn't, and because it's actually looking at the value within the 300 field, mm-hmm. there's no way for it to basically becomes a different key. It becomes a different record in the shared index. So we need to have a better way of kind of doing that publisher normalization so that the key could actually be a better cluster ID.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
The other thing I also wanted to say is if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the implementation specifically on the what it is that Trove and Caval did, Sarah Germain is actually going to be working with Mallory on a presentation tomorrow. She's going to talk a little bit about the social side of it, not necessarily the technical side of it. So I think it's really interesting to learn about how they actually got a lot of these libraries to work together to actually do some of this work. Let's see. Okay.
Yeah, I plugged the presentation that we're doing tomorrow in the chat. It's called Global First Reshares Implementation with the National Library of Australia's Trove. So hopefully you can join us. It'll be early for our Australian friends, but they're going to rock it with me.
Yeah, one of the things that's Sarah's tagline was ISO or GTFO. So that was, she's talking about printing that on either t-shirts or mugs. So anyway, thanks everybody. I really appreciate the time and attention, and look to hear from us a little bit later once the new protocol is out.